rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Larkin, Judge Halbrooks, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater now presiding.
Morning, you may be seated. And welcome to the Court of Appeals, June 7, day after D-Day. We have three matters on our calendar this morning, and this first matter, A221638, in the matter of the welfare of NBM, the child. And as counsel is aware, we'll 15 minutes apiece, 5 minutes for rebuttal. We do ask that when you approach the podium and you're ready, that you identify yourself for the record. So we have that, and counsel for the appellant is ready. You may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Gina Schultz. I'm an assistant appellate public defender, and I represent NBM, whom I will be calling N, the appellant in this matter. There are two issues before this court today, both independently requiring reversal of N's adjudication for first-degree aggravated robbery. First, N's adjudication must be reversed because the district court erred by admitting unreliable identification evidence in violation of his due process rights. The inquiry here is whether police action impermissibly influenced KK's identification of N. That was admitted in evidence here. The test here has two parts. The first is whether the procedure was unnecessarily suggestive. And the record here compels the conclusion that it absolutely was. The procedure here used by Officer Weinman flies in the face of all accepted best practices regarding photo identification arrays. It was not a blinded procedure, despite the district court's conclusion otherwise. Officer Weinman was the lead investigator in the case, and although he didn't know what role any of the suspects were alleged to have played, he knew that all three suspects had been arrested for the offense, and then he, without any filler photos, presented them to KK and SK and asked if any of them looked familiar.
Ms. Schultz, although the record can I ask you, Ms. Schultz?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I saw you use the phrase again today, best practices, and I think the double blind procedure or process that you're referring to, which probably fits in that category. My question is, what does that do for us in terms of legally reviewing the process that was used? Because am I correct that there's never been a case that says this is the process that must be used, and hence, if that's the case, don't we apply more of a deferential standard in the sense that we do look obviously at the case law on suggestive and just kind of look at the facts here and the fact that there's three different individuals, one of which ends up becoming or is your client, but. Do you follow my question?
I think so, Your Honor. And it's true, this court has never said you have to follow every single step of this procedure. But at the same time, if this court is going to assess whether this procedure was unnecessarily suggestive, you need criteria. And this is from the U.S. Department of Justice, and there's a model policy from New York. This isn't a wish list. These are established practices that police departments use. And, you know, we're not even saying, oh, they have to follow every single one. But almost none of these practices were followed in this case.
And how did that impact the reliability of that identification?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't
hear. How did the failure to follow those practices impact the reliability of the identification?
Yeah, Your Honor. So at that point, that's when we would go to the Neal v. Biggers factors. There's five of them. So the first is, and at it's our position that all of those factors weigh in our favor.
And I misphrased my question. Let's take one step back. How did the failure to comply with best practices result in a lineup that was unnecessarily suggestive?
I understand, Your Honor. So in this case, We had two teenage girls, and a police officer comes to
them. And I'll just cut to the chase.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
So we've got three people photographed, so three individual photographs. They're each shown handcuffed in a squad car. They're shown one at a time. They're not put out for comparison. The officer made statements such as, hey, if you don't recognize anybody, that's fine. You don't have to pick someone. All three were white males, as the subject was described. All three were wearing dark sweatshirts, two of them blue, as the victim described. I'm just seeing how that was unnecessarily suggestive. It's not one photo. It's not, you know, one white guy and two people of other races. There's no indication the officer said anything to indicate who was involved, and all the officer knew was that three people had been arrested by the car. He doesn't even know if those three people were among those who took the car. I'm just having a hard time, practically speaking, seeing how this was unnecessarily suggestive.
Okay. Yeah, Your Honor. So, I mean, there were three suspects. They were given three photos, and...
Weren't there two suspects?
Three suspects were arrested.
Right.
And those were the three that were in the photo array.
But there were only two robbers.
Yes, yes, Your Honor. And so the question was, of these three suspects, which two were involved?
And but, one person, SK, identified no one.
Right.
And KK said, that's the person that took the car from me and had the gun, and I was face-to-face with him.
Yeah, and I think where the suggestiveness comes in here is that they were given these three photos, and it was strongly implied, if not expressly stated, these three people were arrested for this offense. And the implication, if not, again, the express instruction, is that someone in here was the person who robbed you. Which one was it? And that's
why wouldn't the implication be two of the people are in here? Which two?
Well, I mean, SK has said, or I'm sorry, KK has said from the beginning that she only really got a good look at one of them. And so in terms of suggestions, she's looking for one person that she saw in, you know, again, going back to the reliability factors here, in a very brief period of time, in a very stressful and traumatic moment. She did not give a fully accurate description of him in the first place, and her level of confidence was fairly confident. And under these circumstances, when she's given three people and functionally told one of these people, you know, these are the suspects in this offense, you know, we arrested them, what do you think? And she wasn't just told that she didn't have to select someone. She was told it would be good or it would be great if she did. And it, this is a teenage girl. You know, she has a person of authority giving her three people that, you know, they have put their imprimatur on as saying, like, these are strongly believed to be suspects. I think the influence there is strong. The suggestion is strong that that you should be selecting one of these people. And it's true she wasn't told that you have to, but...
Doesn't the case law provide that even if a judge finds that there was no due process violation, the identification's coming in, the defense can still cross-examine regarding whether or not the finder of fact should credit that identification?
I agree with that, Your Honor. But at this point, we're appealing the denial of the suppression motion.
I'm just thinking through it. So there could have been a trial at which you could have really hammered to the fact finder all of these reasons not to believe this identification.
That's true. But, of course, it's our position that there was a due process violation.
Understood.
Here. And so it shouldn't have been admitted in the first place.
And when, I assume when deciding whether it was unnecessarily suggestive, we can't consider any other evidence that indicates the correct identification was made, such
No.
as his DNA on the gun,
No.
car keys.
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. And, I mean, to the extent that you can, it's, you know, perhaps in the question of did this influence the verdict? And there, I mean, you do take that into account, but at the same time, as Your Honor pointed out, three people were arrested for this offense that two people committed. And so we have four people actually involved on the tail end, that two of whom were involved in the initial offense. And, you know, we're not denying here that the evidence suggests that he was involved in some way. But was it as a principal or as an aider or abettor in first-degree aggravated robbery, a very serious offense.
Does that make a difference? I mean, if you're guilty of aiding and abetting aggravated robbery, I thought it doesn't matter who did what. You're
yes,
all guilty of the same
thing. That's absolutely right. But I think the other option here is aiding an offender after the fact, which the other two are likely... the evidence suggests they were guilty of, and the evidence suggests perhaps he handled the gun, perhaps he handled the keys, but was it as part of that initial offense, or was it as part of involvement after the fact? And that's where I think we get to, did this affect the verdict? And I think it does. We have...
What evidence is there that he was involved after the fact?
The evidence that he was involved after the fact was that he was present there in or near the ferns, that his DNA was on the gun. But at least two of those people were not involved in the initial robbery. And so the question is, was he one of those people?
Could you talk a little bit about your probable cause argument in the time you have remaining?
Yeah,
probable
absolutely.
Cause to arrest?
Absolutely. So in this case, it seems that everyone is in agreement that a full-blown arrest happened at the time that the police came and ordered and to the ground at gunpoint and then handcuffed him and led him to a police car.
I don't know if everybody agrees because there's a statement in the state's brief indicating it doesn't agree, but I don't know that that necessarily matters to the court because as an appellate court, we're obligated to decide cases in accordance with the law. This is an issue of law. It's reviewed de novo. So even if the state were to make that concession today, it's not binding on this court.
Well,
And it's my impression that state is probably not going to make that concession today. So could you maybe talk a little bit about when the arrest occurred in your view and why you would pin it at that time?
Well, I do want to address very briefly the idea of the concession because my concern here is that the concession at the evidentiary hearing was made in the context of N's counsel developing the record to establish when the arrest happened. And as she was eliciting testimony to develop that record, the prosecutor said, hey, if it helps, I'll just concede that the arrest happened.
Okay.
And if that wasn't, in fact, a concession of this issue, then I think it was... misconduct, cutting off the development of the record, and then later claiming, "Hey, you didn't prove this." So I think that there is a concession.
Understood.
Here.
That's fair.
But Your Honor is absolutely right. This is a question of law, and so at this point, I think Blackston is of course the case that N has relied on throughout this.
I'm thinking of Munson, and I don't know that either side cited that case, and that's a case where the Supreme Court said where the police. We're confronting a car at night that contained several suspects, and they had reason to believe that the suspects might be armed. It was perfectly appropriate to order them out of the car at gunpoint, handcuff them, put them in squads until the police sorted out the situation, and that didn't convert the circumstances to an arrest. It's this idea of freezing the scene when you've got maybe an offense that's a violent offense, there's a gun. It seems that the Supreme Court has given some latitude. Whereas the case you're citing is a circumstance where there's a robbery 2 days ago. We're in the process of getting a search warrant, and we see this person who we know was with the main suspect 2 days ago. Therefore, we're ordering him to the ground at gunpoint, cuffing. That seems very different than 2 hours after the crime, encountering the suspects who are accused of robbing somebody at gunpoint.
I do apologize, Your Honor. I'm sure I've read Munson, but I do not recall any details of that, so I don't know if I can speak to that case in this moment. But at the same time, in this case, we have two children and a very young adult. Who it is true there is an allegation that a weapon was involved.
What was your client's age?
He was 15.
Okay.
At the point that the officers ordered him to the ground, determined that there was not a gun on any of them. At that point, it's a totality of the circumstances assessment of whether it was a reasonable investigative stop rather than a full-blown arrest. And under these circumstances, we've got two children and a very young adult. The police have determined there's no weapon on them. any reasonableness supporting an investigative stop, which we are conceding was reasonable, has evaporated at that point. That's the time for the police to continue with their investigation. And
you're saying that under these circumstances, the police can't keep the suspects in a squad car while they go up and look around the area where they were first encountered?
Well, I think that's what Blackston says, and I understand Your Honor is citing a case that I'm not immediately familiar with, but I think that's what it says. Here we look at
don't we have cases where there are traffic stops and the Supreme Court has said it's okay to keep the person in the squad car for a few minutes while you run the checks?
Well, in this case, again, we have children, and I think it does matter that they're children, and that that the police are—they know that they're safe. They know that there's no gun on them.
How do they know they're not going to run?
I mean, I think because they're surrounded by police is
the answer. How many officers were there at the scene?
That is a good question. I can look at the record briefly before rebuttal.
I didn't get the sense that it was 6 squads, 12 officers, guns drawn. I thought it was 1 squad and a couple of officers.
I can consult the record before rebuttal, Your Honor. Thank you.
And you will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Thank you. Counsel for respondent, you may approach, and when you're ready, you may begin.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I am Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Adam Petras. I represent the respondent in this matter, the state of Minnesota. I hope to briefly address a few points about both issues that appellant raises, and I'll be more than happy to try to answer any questions that this court has. First, the photo identification procedure may not have been absolutely perfect according to the best practices sources that appellant cites, but it was not unnecessarily suggestive. This court's inquiry into whether a photo display or array was unnecessarily suggestive focuses on whether the procedure, quote, unfairly singled out a particular person for identification, end quote. That's from Ostrom. This was not a single person show up. Officer Weinman did not know who perpetrated the carjacking for a lot of the same reasons that Judge Larkin put in her question to opposing counsel. There was not ever a suggestion of one of those three individuals in each of those individual photos having perpetrated the carjacking. I encourage this court to review Exhibit 5, which is the body-worn camera footage that from Officer Weinman when he goes and conducts the photo array with KK and with SK. There's no, I heard there was, may have been a suggestion that there was it was explicitly stated during that interaction. It was not explicitly stated that those three individuals were arrested for the carjacking. It's apparent from the photos. They have been arrested at some point. I'm not disputing that. They're sitting in the back of a squad car. And all three of them very consistently are sitting in the back of the squad car in those three photos. And that goes to the fact that because they were all similarly situated and depicted for KK to review, none of them were unfairly, including appellant, none of them were unfairly singled out suggested that they were the perpetrator.
Was there a break in that exhibit? The tape itself from the
I believe there's multiple breaks. I counted 2 to 3. The whole exhibit itself is, I believe, just over 6 minutes long, and each of those breaks is like a green screen, and that corresponds, the testimony at the first suppression hearing made clear, with a radio transmission that the officer was receiving at the time. And it's a recurring problem, he made clear. It was unfortunate that it was timed with certain parts of that photo array, but at the same time, the testimony was quite consistent from Officer Weinman about how confident KK was in her identification, and that is consistent with the parts of the video that weren't green screened out that you can see, in which she said, he looks familiar, that's him, I'm fairly confident.
But part of the green screen did involve some of her statements, is that correct?
It did. I think it happened twice inside and then once outside
when, if you watch the entire exhibit, the officer's going outside to communicate back with dispatch, or actually I think it was with the Bloomington Police Department, who was were interacting with the suspects. Yes, it did line up with when she was making that identification. And I do want to address one point, because I opened by saying, you know, this was not perfect under best practices. And one thing that could have been different is Officer Wyman could have questioned, been very perhaps forceful, in how he questioned KK and SK together or separately. I think it would have been perhaps ideal if he had questioned them separately. I didn't hear that come up in discussion before. I just wanted to raise that point for the court. However, if you watch Exhibit 5 or just read the party's briefs, I mean, as I believe one of the court's questions made clear before, SK does not feel that she got a good look at either of the two assailants at the Speedway gas station. And so even when kind of encouraged perhaps by KK to corroborate KK's identification, she's like, I didn't get a good look at them. It'd be another thing if SK in response had been like, yeah, I guess that's him, or that could have been him, or if she had in fact had been encouraging KK to make an identification. But practically speaking, it's kind of like SK wasn't really there because she didn't weigh in one way or the other than saying, I'm not confident I got a good look at any of the two people, either of the two people, at the Speedway gas station.
Mr. Petrus, how critical, and I suppose it's critical to the stipulated evidence that led to the conviction, even though this is the pretrial ruling, but I guess my question, how critical was her identification of the appellant to the state's case?
I mean, if we're going to like the harmless error piece of the photo identification issue, I don't think, I think the state could prevail even if this court were to find under both of the photo identification factors, both that this was an unnecessarily suggestive, that it unfairly singled out appellant in that photo array, and that the five factors under Biggers did not support the reliability of the identification. Even if the state were to lose on both of those prongs of the test, I think that the identification itself was not dispositive by any means of appellant's guilt, simply because there was all the evidence that was being previously discussed, the DNA on the gun, where the appellant was found, you know, very close proximity to where the gun and the car keys were being hidden in the ferns. Another fact that didn't come up earlier is the victim's cell phone, which remained in the car, has appellant's fingerprint on it. So that, as opposed to a theory that he was in the ferns trying to, you know, get rid of the or hide or conceal the firearm, and thus was an aider after or aiding the offender kind of after the fact. The fact that his cell phone was still in the car, his fingerprint is on that cell phone, that forensic evidence puts him inside the car. That makes him one of the two people that were approaching and carjacking the vehicle back at the Speedway gas station, even though there were more than two people, four in total, three men, one woman, that were found at the scene on Queen Avenue where the stolen vehicle was recovered. So to respond to your question, Justice Leader, I do not think it was absolutely critical or necessary for the finding of guilt that Judge Bransford reached.
Is my impression correct? I kind of got the impression from the officers this is kind of a routine way to do identification because you're using the cell phones, and it happened fairly quickly. And I remember at the end he even said it was fortunate for you that we, in such a short period of time, found your car and et cetera. And so we talk about these best practices and so forth, and it is true that we keep saying, well, that's not the law, and yet we kind of reference, you know, it's one of those things where you probably should do this and you should do that, and you even made reference to that. Does any of that matter, I guess, to our evaluation? But maybe it's more of a process question.
I totally get what you're saying. And to a certain extent, if we're looking at the two prongs of the test, like holistically, some of them work against each other. I mean, the officers were obviously trying to be efficient. They were trying to work with speed. I mean, carjackings thankfully have fallen off in the last year or so, but this was about a year ago, I believe, that this happened, last June. And, I mean, carjackings were still a very, you know, I mean, a uncontrolled issue throughout Hennepin County. And so the officers were trying to work quickly. Thankfully, there was GPS in the stolen Lexus. Thankfully, they were able to track it to that location in Bloomington. And they found the car within 2 hours of it being stolen. And then there were three people, no one else in sight, on this street that were 25 yards away in the Ferns. So, provided with that information, law enforcement was trying to work quickly, which, of course, is one of the factors, you know, the length of time between that initial confrontation at the scene of the crime and then the photo display. That's the fifth factor under Biggers. That kind of works against, because if they had done a, you know, more formal photo lineup and went and took them the time to, you know, obtain filler photos of people who generally met the white male wearing a blue hooded sweatshirt sitting in the back seat of a squad car to provide photo arrays, that would have taken more time, and it probably wouldn't have been able to be shown to the victim until the following day. So to a certain extent, those factors work against each other, which I think is kind of what your question is driving at, or is that there's about the process that's being followed in this type of situation. And there's maybe different decisions that are better for one part of the process and worse for the others. The last 2 points I want to make with the time that I have left is just to correct something, because there's a contradiction between my brief and opposing counsel's brief about the, under the first factor of the five-factor test, the opportunity of the witness to view the assailant at the time of the crime. There was ample opportunity. It was daylight. I mean, the surveillance video from the Speedway makes that very clear. It was 8:30 p.m. in June. There were no objects between the victim and the assailant was quite close, within a foot of the victim's face. I don't think there's actually any disagreement about those factors. But the way I characterize it is that it was a 50 seconds, and the way that opposing counsel characterized it is 13 seconds. And just, I think the explanation for that is, if you watch Exhibit 6, which is the surveillance video from the Speedway gas station, it doesn't play in real time. It plays up, it's sped up. I mean, people are moving more quickly than they would move in real life. And I encourage you to look at the timestamp if you were to review Exhibit 6. And starting at 8 hours, 36 minutes, and 37 seconds, that is when you can see the assailant within feet of the victim as she's standing outside her car, approach her in a way that you can see that he's holding something and that the victim takes notice of him. For 50 seconds, the next 50 seconds, if you go up ahead to 8 hours, 37 minutes, and 27 seconds. So the next 50 seconds, from 8:36:37 to 8:37:27, under those time steps, under that 50-second period of time, the victim is within feet of the assailant the entire time. That includes the time that he is outside the vehicle. That includes the time that he takes the keys from her. That includes the time that he sits in the driver's seat and she is right outside the driver's side window, hanging onto the car until the point that it drives away and she's thrown to the ground. So I think 13 seconds is probably how long it takes you and I to watch that video, but in real time, under the timestamp of when that was actually happening back in June of 2022, it was a 50-second time period. And the last point I want to make circles back to another one of Judge Larkin's questions about the second issue, the probable cause to arrest. Judge Larkin is correct that in footnote, I think it's footnote 8 on my brief on page 17, I try to put that alleged concession by the trial prosecutor into context. And I believe all he is saying in that concession, to the extent it matters, again, like Judge Larkin pointed out, is that we agree that an arrest occurred. And I encourage this court to read that if on page, I believe it is 41 of the second suppression hearing transcript. Because right after the trial prosecutor says what I quote in that footnote in my brief, Judge Bransford says, "I mean, I didn't think it was disputed either, because that's what the police officer said." And so Judge Bransford, sitting there in the courtroom as the fact finder, is interpreting what the trial prosecutor just said to be consistent with what the police officer witness had just testified to. And that police officer, Officer Walton of Bloomington, is abundantly clear that he believed, I mean, to the extent, again, that matters to this court's review, that he believed he was detaining the individuals, all four of them, three that were found right next to the gun in the Ferns, and as well as the one who was hiding inside the house that the Ferns were next to. He was detaining those individuals until he found the stolen Lexus's keys and the firearm in the Ferns. That's the firearm that eventually was discovered to have appellant's DNA on it. And Munson, Judge Larkin, it is not cited, I believe, in either party's briefing. It is appellant cites in her brief footnote 16 from the Flowers decision. And it's footnote 16 from Flowers is a string cite of a number of cases. One of those is Munson. And so if you were to read Munson, I actually happen to have the quote with me, and that's at pin site 137, or page number 137 of that decision. The Minnesota Supreme Court wrote, 1999, we have also held that briefly handcuffing a suspect while the police sort out the scene of an investigation does not transform an investigatory detention into an arrest, nor does placing the suspect in the back of a squad car while the investigation proceeds. And I believe that very much applies to the situation we have here. Blackstein, which was decided 6 years before Munson, in that case, the defendant was stopped, seized, searched, and de facto arrested 2 days after the robbery while he was legally driving a car that was totally unrelated to the robbery. In Blackstein, we did not have a situation of a defendant digging in, the bushes 25 yards away from a stolen vehicle 2 hours after it had been stolen, very shortly after it had been driven to and located in that area. The facts are so different. And I think that Officer Walton and the few other officers, if I believe it was not a group of six squad cars, but the officers that were also there on Queen Avenue had, I think, a very good reason to approach the situation in the way that they did with detaining by briefly handcuffing and placing in the back of the squad car while they conducted the investigation that quite quickly led to the discovery of the gun and the Lexus's keys. I have 30 seconds left. I'm happy to entertain any other questions this court has.
Appears not to be. Thank you, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you very much.
Counsel for appellant, you now have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I have a few points I want to make, so I will try to get through them quickly. First, I want to answer Judge Larkin's questions from earlier. I'm sure there's a more precise answer in the record somewhere, but on page 5 of the suppression hearing regarding the arrest, Officer Walton says that officers, plural, responded to the scene and that he was one of them, and that before they even did the modified felony stop, several more officers got into the area. So we at the very least, have multiple officers who are involved with this arrest of three children and an adult. I also want to say, I think this may have been paraphrasing, but I want to make absolutely clear. Counsel for the state just said that KK said, "That's him," in the video, and that does not appear in the video. She says, at the end of that first 7-second blackout, she says, "I'm fairly confident." And then when Officer Weinman brings her back to N's photograph, she says, "Yeah, he looks for yes." There's nothing in the record saying that where she says that's him. And then one more point.
Can I just clarify? There's no dispute, though, that she did identify your client.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. There's no dispute there. Let's see. I'm sorry. What's the other? Okay. Counsel for the State also mentioned that there was no explicit indication to SK or KK that these three suspects had been arrested for the offense. So I just want to bring this court's attention to page 43 of that suppression hearing. There, Officer Weinman's testimony, he's asked if he told the suspects, if he told SK and KK that the suspects had been detained by Bloomington police. And he says, "There might have been mention of that. I don't recall." Then he says, "Yes, but we did tell them that the car had been discovered by the Bloomington police." And then he's asked, "And that four people were detained, believed to be related to the stolen vehicle." And he says, "That sounds about right." So that is, to me, sounds like an explicit acknowledgement that these three people had been arrested for the offense. And that's why I hedged a little bit that was it totally explicit or was it very strongly implied? I think at the very least it was strongly implied, not least by the fact that they were photographed in the back of the squad car, but also by Officer Weinman's comments. As far as And fingerprint on the cell phone, I take counsel's point there, certainly. But here we're talking about an impact analysis. So this isn't a sufficiency of the evidence review. We're talking about what impact did this identification evidence have on the verdict. And here it is the strongest evidence tying N to the actual robbery. And I don't think there's any, that is strong evidence tying him to the inside of the car, but we don't know when the other two people became involved. Were they picked up right away? Did they meet them, at the juvenile's house outside the Ferns? That actually seems like the least likely scenario, because as Officer Walton testified, I think it was about 45 seconds between the car being abandoned and them finding and his companions outside the home. So most likely scenario is that whoever joined the group after the robbery, it happened before that moment, and they were all probably in the car together. In terms of the best practices, again, this is not a wish list. These are established practices, and if this procedure isn't unnecessarily suggestive, I don't know what would be. Functionally, it's a one-photo array. We've got three suspects, three male suspects. They're shown three photos. They're told these people were arrested for this offense. That is extremely suggestive. And I hear that only N was actually picked out, but at the same time, it was strongly suggested the suspect, the person who robbed you, is in this array. And SK did select someone in that array. And even after that level of suggestion, she only rose to the level of being fairly confident that he looked familiar. I see that I'm running out of time, but we ask this court to reverse N's adjudication. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions, your comments, as well as your briefing. We will take the matter under advisement, issue an order within 90 days. You each have a good day.
Thank you. You as well.
Thank you.